The information in this skill is provided for informational and educational purposes only.
Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 63. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Joining me today is my friend Hugo Trevino from Chicago, Illinois. Hugo is a disability advocate and an academic advisor for students with disabilities at the University of Illinois in Chicago, and he has SMA type 3. Hugo, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Kevin. I'm so excited.
Absolutely. I think this will be a really good one. And before we get started, I just wanted to remind listeners out there that it is SMA Awareness Month. And if you've seen on our main website or our social media pages, we are doing 31 days of SMA. Again, we've got some great stories for that. So be sure to follow us there. You can check out a wide range of stories from people in the community. So just wanted to plug that real quick. So Hugo, just a little background for listeners. So Hugo and I met at one of the SMA conferences. This was like years ago. I think I remember first time I met you, you were doing a panel it was for college. And like, that was when I was just starting to get into and like look into applying for colleges. And it was really cool to see like several adults up there and college students like kind of share their experiences. So it's like, I've always known you as a strong disability advocate, very invested in the community. But I want to ask, like, thinking about when you were growing up and after you've been diagnosed, you know, what was it like for you growing up with a disability? Because I imagine kind of like that transition to becoming a really advocate was, you know, it happened over time, right?
Yeah, I always tell people that advocacy does not happen overnight. So if you're struggling with self-advocacy and just kind of speaking up for yourself, to just kind of keep practicing at it and chipping away. My strongest advice is if something feels wrong to you, to believe in your gut, you know, and not be afraid to voice your opinion. And, you know, and that's something that even me, as I kind of, it's easier when you see someone else going through an injustice than when you're going through your own self-injustice. So make sure that, you know, try to think about yourself in that perspective of, you know, would you give this advice to someone else if they were in your, you know, in your same shoes? And, you know, if the answer is no, then, you know, go for it, you know, and self-advocate. But as far as my advocacy, kind of the way it happened was, I think as a child, even though I grew up in Chicago, in the Chicagoland area, I grew up in Cicero. I had, for example, I went to like a high school with 4,000 students, you know, it was a huge high school, but throughout my entire upbringing, all the way from kindergarten up to high school, for the most part, I was still usually the only child with a disability, especially in regular education classes or even like honors classes, you know, and so that was definitely hard of, you know, being disabled and being Latino and also just being first generation. And so I remember drawing inspiration from my older sister, Lucy. She also has spinal muscular atrophy. And so she would always tell me, you know, of the things that she went through. And I think she knocked down a lot of barriers for me so that when it was my turn, you know, I always remembered and thought back to, you know, Lucy and like what she had to go through. And she would also be like, hey, you know, I went through this. This is what I had to fight for. And she'd be like, you know, they might try to do this again or they might whatever. And so she was also very strong in like helping me instill advocacy skills within myself. And also my mom, you know, it's going to sound kind of funny, but because I was first generation, you know, and my mom sometimes needed a translator for certain meetings, my mom would make sure that I was in those meetings. So that, you know, whatever was being said about me should always be like, you know, did the translator do a good job translating? And I'd be like, yeah, she did. And my mom would be like, you know, these decisions that they're making about you, are, do you agree with them, you know? And so I would always be like, you know, also kind of like telling her like, oh, no, I'm not okay with this. And like, just little things like that. My mom also was very empowering in making sure that I was part of the decisions that were being made on my behalf, you know. She would obviously tell me how she felt about it and then would ask my input. Obviously, being a parent, sometimes, you know, she'd be like, oh, no, that's not what I think. But a lot of the times she would definitely take my input into consideration. And that's how a lot of my advocacy also started. And also just in general, growing up, I was also lucky to attend the MDA summer camp every summer. And so going to that MDA summer camp is where I got to see older also adults with spinal muscular atrophy, kind of like how Kevin mentioned. that he saw me at the conferences. That's what the camp was for me as well. Because I didn't start attending the QRSMA conferences until I was an adult. And so, so MDA summer camp, that's where I saw a lot of older campers that were going off to college, and I would try to listen in to what colleges they were going to. And the University of Illinois is actually one of the top three most accessible colleges in the nation. And so I remember in my mind being like, oh my God, that's an in-state school. I need to fight hard and study hard because I want that independence. When I go off to college, I want to go off to college. I want to have the full college experience, you know, and I don't want to live at home. So it definitely took family. It took my community and, you know, just being around other people with disabilities to kind of gain advocacy skills and kind of pull inspiration from everyone to get to where I am today.
Sure. Well, and back to on your family life. So, yes, I know Lucy has SMA as well. I can't remember. Do you have any other siblings too?
So, yeah. So in total, there's four of us. So Lucy is the oldest.
Okay.
And she was born with spinal muscular atrophy. And then 2 years later, Maria was born, and she does not have any type of disability.
Gotcha.
And then I was born 4 years after that. And I think that's when my parents were finally fully understanding, because Lucy didn't get diagnosed until the age of five.
Wow.
So I was born a year later after Lucy was diagnosed. You know, they definitely started the diagnosis process earlier than that. Like when she was three is when she started showing symptoms. And Lucy was ambulatory. She's also a type three. She would walk. But my mom did notice that there was something, you know, a little bit different in her gait, and just like the way that she would get up from the floor. But, you know, this also being back in the, you know, in the late 80s, that it was kind of hard for doctors, you know, to really to understand what was happening, to even know what SMA was. Now, you know, thankfully there's screenings and there's more DNA, you know, testing to be done to be able to determine whether someone has SMA or not. But back in the day, my mom also fought through, you know, doctors telling her that it was in her head, that, you know, that some kids do walk strangely at the beginning, but then they, you know, they readjust. And so my mom really had to persist. And so it wasn't until by the time that I was born that my mom finally understood, like, oh my God, like, you know, what the disability was, and was barely understanding the severity of it. And then when I was born and I started showing the same symptoms, you know, then going through all of it and then understanding the genetic aspect of that too. And then after me, my younger brother was born 4 years after that. And so, you know, and so that it was just a crazy journey of, you know, of not really understanding the disease and kind of learning little by little. About what it meant and the fact that it was genetic. And so now my mom talked about it too, of like, oh my God, you know, like it's crazy that I ended up having four children. Cause you know, every time she did have a child, there was a 25% chance for one of us to be born with the mutation for spinal muscular atrophy. And so she's, you know, she says that it's just incredible, like how much they just didn't know, back then in the day too, or, you know, or she probably would have stopped having children way early on.
Well, that's the thing. The genetics are fascinating. It's like, yeah. I'm the only one in my family who has SMA. I know plenty of other families that they're like, they have a sibling with, or they have like all have it, or only one does. Or in your case, it's like half and half. And
yeah.
it's really fascinating. But but that's pretty cool. And I think, yeah, no, going back to what you were saying about how like Lucy's experiences helped you in, you know, your schooling experience and all that. You know, are there any specific instances where like, you know, you encountered something that she had dealt with, whether it was like inaccessibility in a classroom or something like that, that you were able to kind of learn from her experiences?
Oh my God, I could think of two really easily off the bat. So I remember she told me to try to petition and get out of like having a resource class, almost study hall. And so in high school, when I got into high school, I placed into almost all honors classes. And so the high school was very afraid that, like, oh, my God, I wasn't going to be able to cope and deal with it. And so my sister was like, oh, you know, get out of that research class, because if you're going to college, you know, you're going to need electives. And that was something that she struggled to get out of. And then she struggled to, you know, be able to sign up for more electives. Or I think they also had something where you could do like 0 hour, and she took classes maybe before other students.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's how she was able to get classes back. But she's like, don't let them do that to you. You know, go to school during regular school hours. instead of them forcing you to be in a resource class. So I remember I advocated to get out of a resource class, and we talked about it too during my IEP, because my first semester, my freshman year, during the resource class, because I was smart and just like a good kid overall, I would do my homework actually at home. So then during the resource class, I would either use it to go use the bathroom, which is dumb, you know, right? Or I would use it, or the class, you know, it was 30 students. A lot of them had learning disabilities or behavioral disabilities. So that's why they were in there. And also think about that I wasn't placed in a regular, you know, study hour class. I was placed in a class with students with other disabilities.
Right.
And so ended up happening was that I became a tutor and I was helping out the resource teacher. So during those 50 minutes every day, I would go around to different people's desks, just like the resource teacher would, and I would help them with their homework, you know? And so I just remember being like, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing. And so I fought to get out of that so that then I can take, you know, an art class or a language class, which I also needed. And so that was one thing that, you know, thanks to my sister, I was able to kind of get rid of my resource class, you know, sooner than she was. Another aspect was when she graduated, they also gave her kind of like an uphill battle. And she didn't want to, or they didn't want to let her graduate on stage because it wasn't wheelchair accessible. So they rented a temporary ramp for her because she finally did fight for it. And so I remember her telling me as well, like, Hugo, if they tell you can't graduate on stage, you know, give them hell. Maybe put it in your IEP because she did not have it on hers. So I've also put that. And when I mention IEP, that means Individualized Education Plan. I know that for some listeners, depending on the state that you're in, it might be called a 504 plan, which is named after the law. And so we put it in my IEP or 504 plan. And when it was time for graduation, guess what happened? Again, they were telling me that the ramp was not wheelchair accessible and that I would have to, you know, that they were more than happy to have, you know, the principal and everyone walk up stage and present me with my diploma. And so we were like, no, that's not okay. Like, you know, I also graduated with being in the honor society and, you know, I'm like the top 5% of my high school. And so I just remember them being like, me being like, you know, I got to graduate before everyone else. And so I was like, no, that's not how we're going to start this. And so it was awesome for them to hear that they had now bought a permanent ramp now that the school was going to have instead of just renting one. And so they made the stage accessible. But I also remember that my classmates were also like, oh, well, we're protesting. If you don't get to graduate on stage, then we're all not going to graduate on stage. We're just going to walk by the stage and they can give us all our diplomas off the stage. And so I remember just feeling empowered by my classmates, too, that, you know, they were all backing me up as well. But those are just two clear examples of how my sister was like, here are two things that they might discriminate against you because they did it to me. And so don't let them do that to you as well.
For our listeners out there, like, I'm shaking my head, like, not out of shock, but just like the fact that happens. Like, and it happened twice. Like, yeah, but I do love that all your peers backed you up and, you know, that's, but it's just crazy. And we'll get to that in a little bit, too, talking about how that's an example of, like, ableism and discrimination. But I'll get to that in a little bit. But while we're on the subject, too, of, like, school and, you know, you mentioned earlier that you knew you wanted to have the full college experience when you got to that point. So what were the steps you took in order to achieve that, like, in terms of living on campus, getting the help you needed, all of that?
Sure. So when I looked at the University of Illinois, the first thing that was very important for me was for me to be able to hire my own personal care attendants, PCAs, as some people call them. I just call them PAs, personal assistants. And so, for my state, I needed to sign up through the Department of Human Services. And I know that's usually how most states deal with it, too. But you do have to look at every state does do it a little bit differently for people listening in. So just kind of, if you type in like DHS, like, you know, like disability services, things like that, those are some keywords that you can look up. But the University of Illinois had a dormitory specifically just for people with disabilities. So I remember touring it. All the rooms were super accessible. We had, you know, a wheelchair accessible bathroom, and, you know, with the walk-in showers, and, you know, roll-in sinks, where I can roll underneath it, I mean. And so these were all just kind of factors that I wanted. They also had a list of students who the university would actually hire, and then we can pick off a list. And so they would kind of give you that list for you to pick from this pool of students to be your PCAs. But as the years progressed, then they kind of wanted you to create your own list and to learn how to interview people. And so these were all important skills for me. When I picked my university, I always like to joke around that, you know, it was 2.5 hours from Chicago, south of Chicago. And so it was far away so that, you know, I can live independently, but close enough so that my parents could visit me in case something did happen. And so, which they did, you know, and so and that was always awesome for when I did need a little bit more help or a little bit more encouragement, or maybe I did get homesick. But overall, college, I always encourage everyone that's like the big safety net of if you want to explore having your independence, college is the best place to do that at. And I also tell students whenever they ask me about like, oh, Hugo, how'd you pick your university? You know, don't be afraid to go on different campuses' websites. Look to see if they have a disability resource center or maybe, you know, an ability center. I don't know what they're called, but just know that the ADA and Section 504 does make it law and a requirement for all universities, whether they're private or public, to have some type of disability resource center to be able to assist students. Because, you know, FAFSA is federally funded money and the ADA and 504 are federally funded law. So that's what kind of makes them have to be accessible. But look at their websites. And if they have a robust website, you know, with a lot of employees and a lot of resources, usually that's a pretty good indication that they care about their students and they want more students with disabilities at that university. But if you're looking at your dream college, whether it's a small university or a big one, and you see that in the Disability Resource Center page, they maybe only have 3 employees and the website is hardly developed and you can't really navigate around it, then that's usually a good indicator that maybe you should rethink that choice of attending that college. Or if your heart is set on attending that college, then maybe you need to realize that, you know, you're going to be fighting a lot of ableistic kind of viewpoints. And that you are probably going to be a pioneer for that university. And most of the things that you fight for you are probably going to be leading the way for future students. But again, you need to think about, like, is that something that you want to do, you know, be fighting an uphill battle during my 4 years at this university, or maybe, you know, more than 4 years. And, you know, or do I want to go to another university? I'm not saying that my university was perfect, but the fact that, you know, they did have a robust program, you know, kind of made me feel safer that I was able to kind of advocate a little bit more for myself and fight for a little bit more services, you know, and they were willing to meet me, you know, just because they were more developed than maybe another university that doesn't have as much funding for disability services.
Absolutely. You know, I've talked about that before too, is like, I don't think any university is going to be perfect in that regard, but that's yeah. You know, why I chose my alma mater was like, they had a good disability services office and that was very important to me as well. So, and you know, while you mentioned that, you know, I mean, we talked about it a little bit earlier, but like, so, you know, since it is SMA Awareness Month and July was Disability Pride Month, you know, the concept of ableism comes up a lot in conversations and on social media and whatnot. So can you kind of put into your own words, like what that means and, you know, and like also what systemic ableism means, you know, like, as I feel like a lot of people have like heard that term, but they don't really know exactly what it means.
Definitely. So for me, ableism, it kind of means, man, this is so tricky. For me, ableism is when someone who is able-bodied, you know, thinks that just because they can enter or they can exist in that, you know, in their current environment, that, you know, that it's not an issue for anybody else. And so that's kind of ableism, maybe in a small nutshell. For me, also, ableism is also the lack of wanting to understand others, right? So when you see someone in a wheelchair automatically thinking, oh, that person must also have like a mental disability, right? Or that person is less than me, or, you know, and I keep saying the word or, because it doesn't have to be all of these things. It could just be one of these things. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, or just feeling bad for someone because they're in a wheelchair, or, you know, and so it's all these different things that I think that's ableism. And the last or that I'll say will also be, you know, someone seeing someone in a wheelchair, or just, and someone, you know, with a disability, and thinking, you know, I don't want to get to meet this person just because of their disability. Like, is it going to be awkward me talking about, you know, talking to them? Or sometimes too, I've had people where they're afraid of like building a relationship with someone with a disability because they feel that their life expectancy isn't going to be that long. And so they don't want to lose a friend at an early age. And so once again, like I feel that, you know, they are feeling sadness for us just simply because we're existing with our disabilities. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they don't want to get to know us and or get to know how they can make the world a little bit better and easier for us is ableism, right? Because they're just thinking that, you know, if it's out of mind, then they don't need to think, you know, out of sight, I mean, then it'll be out of their mind and they don't need to worry about it. And also just in general, too, I think systemic ableism is the fact that they, you know, don't want to improve healthcare for people in general. You know, a lot of the times you might hear that, you know, people will say, oh, now that this person with a disability, now that they died, now they're truly free, right? And you know what? I want to say that I don't think we're free when we're dead. That's not how you give us freedom. We are granted freedom when we're allowed access to healthcare, access to durable medical equipment, and access to treatment. These are all things that are giving us longer lives, that are giving us more independent, and that's how you give us our freedom. We don't get freedom when we die, you know? And so that's also ableistic to think that, oh, they're suffering constantly with their disability. And also the system is thinking that, you know, oh my God, they got it, you know, they have all this good life living with personal assistance when these systems are meant to keep us in poverty. You know, we're not allowed to have more than $2,000 in our bank. We're not allowed to get married. And some people might think, you know, oh, show me a law that says that. Well, the laws are there because, you know, if we do step over these things, we do get punished, you know, and it's part of the ADA. That's the law that you need to look at. The ADA is not protecting us against living impoverished lives. And so if you need to look at any law, look at the ADA. It was amended 30 years ago, or it was, you know, not amended, it was enacted 30 years ago.
Right.
Since then, it's only been amended once, and that amendment wasn't to make the ADA more robust. The only thing that amendment was to include to broaden the definition of who is disabled to include more people with, like, invisible disabilities, such as, you know, learning disabilities and psychological disabilities and chronic disabilities. But overall, the ADA has not been amended in order to include more freedoms for people with disabilities. And so now that a whole generation of us have grown up with the ADA, for example, I'm 31, so I lived in a world without the ADA for 1 year of my life. But now that I've grown up with it, there are so many things that now, you know, I can no longer live in this small little definition of what the ADA is. And so I guess you could say I'm bursting at the seams and I need the ADA to adapt with me so that I can gain more independence instead of it just hindering my independence of what they thought independence should look like back in the 90s when it was passed. And I think the same thing goes with what's happening now with the civil rights movement, right? Back in the day when the civil rights law was passed in the 60s, you know, that's what they thought that, you know, civil rights looked like back in the day. But as you can see, it's still robust and systemic that we need new, you know, civil rights laws that are going to define, you know what, these spaces, you know, we got to, you know, X, but now we need to keep moving forward or otherwise we're going to move backwards, you know. And yeah. So another thing, too, that I always tell people in regards to the ADA is I was able to study abroad as an undergrad. And I was able to do two trips where we were specifically going abroad to kind of learn about the ADA system in other countries. And so the two countries that I got to study were Costa Rica and Taiwan. And both countries, what they mentioned was that they actually looked at our ADA to write up their own version of their ADA. And they found a lot of these loopholes. And so when they passed their ADA law in their respective countries, they actually made it better. So if we don't amend our ADA, we're going to realize that other countries are going to surpass us, and we're going to stay in it back in the, you know, we're going to be behind. Instead of being a progressive country, we're not going to be there.
That's, I love that you said that, because I was going to ask too, but I know you've done a lot of international travel over the years, but that's fascinating. I did not know that about that, you know, when you went there, they were looking at our version and, you know, made adjustments as a result. But that's really fascinating. Before I get into that, I want to ask real quick, what was your major as an undergrad? I forgot.
So as an undergraduate student, I did start off as architecture.
Okay.
With that, there was a lot of systemic racism within, or not racism, systemic ableism within the architecture field. So unfortunately, even though that had been my dream as a child growing up in Chicago, we have beautiful architecture, and I just always hated having to enter through the back of buildings, having to enter through alleyways, not being able to enter certain restaurants, you know, especially on the north side of Chicago where they have a lot of good restaurants, and you know, me, you know, being super excited to try a new pizza place or whatever, a burger place, and being turned down at the door, you know. And after, at the beginning, I would get takeout. But after a while, I was like, you know what? No, they don't deserve my business. I'm not going to get takeout from this restaurant, you know, because I did not make, you know, my whole drive out here just to take my food back to my home. And so instead, I would eat somewhere else where the restaurant was accessible. But the ableism that I experienced within my major was the fact that I remember at the beginning when we were creating models for the first time, this was my sophomore year, I went up to one of my professors and I let him know, you know, that I was really struggling with cutting materials, even foam core, right? Which is just literally what I said, foam with like paper stuck on top of it so that you can draw on it. And I was explaining to him about how I was struggling to cut it with an X-Acto knife. And my professor told me if you know, if he could meet with me. I guess he felt uncomfortable talking to me in front of the students, which I appreciated because that's what I wanted as well. Well, when I went to his office, he gave me a lecture for 30 minutes. I remember I kept looking at my watch on my and he told me about how we all just need to have the drive to do things. And if I, you know, and if I became more goal-oriented and my dream was to become an architecture, and if I put more of my drive behind my will, that, you know, I could cut the foam core, right? And that I could build these models. And so I just let him keep talking. And for the 30 minutes after he was done, I think in like a matter of 5 minutes, I explained to him, or maybe even less, I'm like, okay, I'm like, well, let me tell you now. I'm like, I have a disability. I'm like, physically, I'm like, even if you give me foam core, I'm like, or a sheet of paper, it would take me a really long time for me to cut it. I would have to press up against with my knife, like up against the foam core, maybe 100 times for my knife to go through the entire foam, whereas any other architecture student would maybe just cut through it once and it would, you know, do a clean cut. And then I was just explaining to him that, like, physically, even if I wanted to, I would not be able to raise my hand above my head. And physically, even if I wanted to, with all the will in my body, I would not be able to carry certain pieces of wood or, you know, go with the saw and even cut a piece of wood if I can't cut a piece of foam core. And so he was so apologetic, felt so dumb, you know, afterwards, apologized profusely for not understanding what my disability was. And so that was one example of how, you know, even me by myself, my parents never told me I couldn't be an architect. They kind of let me figure that out by myself, which I actually thank them, because I think it's better for parents to not be discouraging, but for instead to let us figure out what is realistic in regards to a career path or not. But even with that, then I, you know, after he realized that, you know, I needed more help, I was able to hire students, but I always had to be students that were a year below me. So as a sophomore, I could only hire freshmen. As a junior, I could only hire sophomores. And so the hard part about that was that I was learning how to be an architect myself and how to work with these materials. And then I had to teach someone something that I didn't even know yet, how to do that job. And so once again, in my viewpoint, that was very ableistic, that they felt like they were enabling me to be able to build those models. But at the same time, they weren't realizing that, you know, and an ableist or that not everyone has the ability to do this. And even able-bodied people are barely learning these skills for the first time. So it was just, yeah, it was a lot of uphill battles. Anyways, long story, after that, I switched majors. I became a Spanish major, and then I got a minor in translation studies. Just because at that time I did not want to be a teacher, which was a lot for a lot of people, the only route was teaching if they got a Spanish major.
Gotcha. That's really interesting. I did. That's another thing I did not know about the architecture. Yeah. But no, in my head I'm going, hey, yeah, you're just being lazy. Just work harder.
Exactly. What he said in like his real like nicely worded speech was kind of like telling me stop being lazy, and you could also build models.
Yeah, I mean, forget SMA. You don't. You're just making excuses. But that's crazy, though. But that's interesting. Okay, so you went. Then you went to Spanish, and then I know. I'm talking about your work life. So I know you worked for the MDA for a while. Was that your first like big job out of college, or what did you do initially out of undergrad?
Oh, okay. So out of undergrad, my first job, I became very lucky. I actually landed a job with the Waukegan Public Library. Which is a suburb of Chicago, but it's like 40 minutes away from Chicago, so it's pretty far. And the really awesome job about that was that my friend was already working at the library, and I kind of just put it on my Facebook. So I do recommend that networking is the best way for people to get jobs when they are looking for jobs. You know, don't be afraid to create a LinkedIn profile and maybe make a status that you're looking for a job. At the time, I did not have LinkedIn. It still wasn't that big. So I just put it on my Facebook. I let people know that I was looking for a job in translation. And so I did get a job with the Waukegan Public Library, translating a lot of their community services and a lot of their materials. And the cool thing about that job was that I got to work from home. And so I absolutely loved it. I would wake up every morning at 9 a.m. If they had translation things for me to do, then I would get up, you know, or at 8 a.m. if they didn't have anything, then I would kind of get back up like every hour and check my phone until like 10. And then I would start my day. But then after that job, that was more of a part-time job. And then I finally landed more of a full-time gig working for the Chicago Lighthouse, which was a center for people that are blind or have low vision. And there are a lot of lighthouses. They're also a national organization in different cities. So I don't know if there's one out by you, Kevin, but I'm sure if you Googled it, I'm sure you probably would find something very similar to a lighthouse.
Sure.
And so that was my first nonprofit work of working with people with disabilities. And I was very grateful for that job. When I landed that job, they were specifically looking to hire people with disabilities, which I was actually having a really hard time landing a job. And this is another way in which ableism is systemic, in the fact that my resume was pretty impressive. I had traveled abroad, you know, a bunch of times. I would go through first interviews, and then I would even get a second interview. And usually the first interview would be over the phone. And then the second interview is when they would invite me into the office. And even though people might think that, oh, people are not ableist, they were being ableist, and it is systemic, the fact that all jobs did not think that I had the ability to do my job, you know. And so I was very happy that the Chicago Lighthouse, you know, a place where they do hire, or where they were looking to hire people with disabilities, that they did hire me, because that was the first time where then I went from having a full part-time job to a full-time job. And so I was working both jobs actually for a while at the Lighthouse and at the Waukegan Public Library. And then from there, I went on to work with the Muscular Dystrophy Association, specifically in their resource center, to help families get connected, you know, to multidisciplinary care centers. And those are like hospitals where they could find, you know, doctors that understand their rare neurological disease. Also get connected to clinical trials and things like that. And a lot of the times I wish that MDA, instead of being called the Muscular Dystrophy Association, I wish they were called the Muscle Disease Association, because, you know, they cover 43 different diseases. And not all of them, they don't cover 43 different muscular dystrophies. They cover 43 different neurological diseases, spinal muscular atrophy being one of them, you know. And so our atrophy is very different from a dystrophy, and so on and so on.
Yeah. That's a really good point. I thought about that too. It's like, I have a longstanding relationship with the MDA and done a lot of work with them, but that's a really good point, because, I mean, like, SMA is fairly close, but then there are a lot of them that aren't really, you know, like, fall under that umbrella, so
exactly.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah.
And they would still be called the MDA, but they could just be called the Muscle Disease Association.
Right. That makes it simple, yeah. That's really interesting. And so, okay, so you, and by the way, I mean, I know we could say we're going a little, like, close to time here, but you and I could talk all day, and I know we have, like, plenty of stories to tell, but I did want to, okay, so you went to the MDA, and then now you're working back in academia, and I know you've gone to grad school. Yep. Can you talk a little bit about what led to that job now and kind of what you do there?
Yeah, so, so sometimes it's kind of funny because, so when I was at the Lighthouse, unfortunately, I was doing a lot of customer service, and customers can be mean, especially over the line. So I wasn't the happiest with that job. And just people being really mean, it takes a toll on you, just mentally. And so I always tell people when it rains, it pours, right? So I wasn't too happy with that job. And I just wanted something where I could be making a little bit more money as well. Because I was making maybe just a dollar or two over the minimum wage when I was kind of working there. And so in general, I loved college. I loved helping people. I loved being a mentor to other students with disabilities during my entire time there. Even when I went abroad, I was an ambassador, and my goal was to get more people that with disabilities to kind of go abroad. I also helped create the Enable the Abroad scholarship. So I wanted more people to keep using that scholarship so it wouldn't go away. And so in my mind, I was like, oh, my God, I love college so much, and more universities could be accessible. Let me get my master's in higher education. And so I was very lucky that Loyola University Chicago here in Illinois actually had an online program that was an option. And so I never in my wildest dreams did I think that I was going to get my job at MDA, which it was one of my dream jobs to work with people directly with people with my type of disability or similar. And so within, I think, a one-week time frame, I got my acceptance letter from Loyola, and I also got my acceptance letter from MDA that I was going to be working there. And so luckily, Loyola had an online track, and so I was able to sign up and switch my classes to the online system. And even for someone with spinal muscular atrophy, I was able to work full-time and go to school full-time. And I'm also very grateful for MDA because we had access to my job, or to the building 24 hours a day, pretty much. And so what would happen was that as soon as 5 o'clock hit, I would sign out of my system or out of the system, and then I would just stay in my cubicle and keep doing homework from 5 to 10, 5 to 11, so that, I wouldn't have anyone bothering me or distracting me. And that's where I would get a lot of my work done as well, just within my office at MDA. And so during the entire time that I worked at MDA, I worked there for 3 years, I completed my master's degree. And then soon after, I then pursued and got a job fairly quickly after I graduated with the University of Illinois in Chicago. They were also looking for someone to help people with disabilities. And so my previous title at MDA was Disability Resource Specialist. And now, I'm a disability, I don't know, but they were very similar. The names were basically the same. Now I'm just an academic advisor specifically for students with disabilities, but I couldn't have aligned way better the fact that they were also looking to help students with disabilities. I still, in the back of my mind would have, after I joined MDA, I almost wish that instead of getting a master's of education, that I would have maybe have gotten a master's of public health, just because I continue to love helping people with disabilities. I think that, access to healthcare is a human right. And the fact that, that right now they're fighting our current administration to make our disabilities pre-existing conditions again. I think that's one simple way in which ableism is systemic. And I just think that we need to keep fighting to amend the ADA and have it include more rights. And just also we need to never stop fighting for our right to healthcare and things like that. So right now, with everything happening with all the civil unrest, there are so many different things that you can join the movement. The Black Lives Matter movement is also talking about more funding for healthcare system, better education for special ed programs, just better funding overall for mental health as well. I know that right now a lot of us, we're taking a mental toll. With having a disability, we're used to sometimes being isolated, but I think that the quarantine is taking it up to a whole new level. And I think we're also experiencing kind of the trauma of also not knowing whether our PAs can come PA for us, whether they need to quarantine, It's not harder to hire PAs, you know, and people to travel to our place. And so these are all things that, you know, are affecting not only us, but like, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement. It's affecting Latinos. It's affecting, you know, every single race. And so I think that, you know, if we all join together so that we all have more civil rights, then we all end up winning, right?
Absolutely. Well, and on that note, Hugo, too, you know, I know in your, you contributed to 31 Days of SMA last year, and you talked in that post about intersectionality and, you know, your identities as Latino, LGBT, and, you know, having SMA. So can you talk about that just briefly, too, and, like, you know, how those identities intersect and, you know, how it's really shaped the work you do now and everything else?
Yeah, definitely. So I think it all stems also, I mean, like when you're little, right, I grew up in a predominantly Latino neighborhood here in Chicago. And so that was like the first identity that I accepted. My parents, with, you know, both me and my sister both having a disability, you know, our house was, you know, was always kind of accessible, or it slowly became more and more accessible. Our parents treated me and my sister normal. Or I guess as normal, right? I hate saying that word normal, so air quotes.
Sure, sure.
What I said word. But that's when we also started noticing, like, for example, I remember our local church that we loved going to had stairs and no ramps. Mm-hmm. And so I remember as my disability was progressing and as my sister's disability was progressing, and also as we were getting bigger and bigger, it started getting harder for our parents to carry us into the church. And so I remember just that being one big sign of, like, things are changing, because now my parents, you know, had to switch churches because it was getting too hard for them to carry two kids with disabilities into a church and not just one, you know. And so, I don't know. And so there was that intersectionality of, like, you know, me accepting that I was Latino, but then also kind of grappling with the intersectionality of, like, what is going to be my faith because of my disability. And then as I kept getting older, you know, you know, being just first generation and kind of, you know, kind of maneuvering through the college experience, you know, for the first time too on my own, being the first one to move away from college and also having a disability. And then finally, maybe the hardest intersection or of identity that I had, the hardest one embracing, was, you know, me just being, you know, part of the gay community or identifying as, you know, a gay male. And so with that one too, that one was also particularly hard for me to grasp, because, you know, in my mind, I kept telling myself, you know, I already get discriminated against because of my wheelchair. You know, I'm already not allowed into so many spaces because of my wheelchair. Like, do I want to feel also the discrimination of not being allowed into spaces because of, like, because of who I love, or, you know, or because, you know, I'm gay or anything like that? And then also the way that that interacted with being a Latino, you know, and, like, you could say that there's, like, machismo, you know, or that, you know, there's, like, homophobia in the Latino community. But, you know, it's not just, you know, it's not just an issue that's, you know, just specific to Latino community. I know it happens within all races as well. And so it was kind of hard of, like, you know, coming to terms, but also even accepting my disability as I was growing up. As, like I said, you know, identifying with Latino came easy, you know, because I grew up in this community. But I was the only person that was disabled. And so after, you know, growing up, I did kind of want that cure. I did want, you know, that little magic pill, or I did hate the fact that, you know, I went from, you know, having to use a walker to having to use a manual chair to having to use a power chair. And even as I got older, to having to use a breathing machine at night, I remember that was also, like, this is going to sound funny, but I'm sure you probably have talked about this too, feeling like you're becoming more and more disabled.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so, like, and so that sounds funny because, like, okay, you're already disabled, but, like, you know, the fact that I have to use another machine for durable medical equipment is like, oh my God, when is it going to stop? Right.
And or even so, just like in my case, like when my arm strength started to decline and stuff like that, like I think about, you know, where I've always used a wheelchair, but abilities that I once had started to deteriorate away. And yeah, I absolutely had that same struggle in high school.
I remember I used to get tired eating cereal, so I stopped eating cereal. And then I was like, oh my God, I also cannot eat soups because my hand is not steady and I just spill, like, soup all over myself. And so, or even being able to eat a bag of chips of popcorn. I love popcorn, but that constant motion of moving my hand up and down, you know, to reach for my mouth, you know, to grab one kernel, you know, it was becoming a lot. And so, yeah, Kevin, I love that you brought that up, but it's like these little things where it's like, okay, well, I can't walk, but my wheelchair gives me independence, but now it's like I can't even use my arms. Mm-hmm. Like, what's going to give me independence for that? And I know that you also have assistive technology to help you with that, which is
amazing. Well, it worked out for me. I got a really awesome robotic arm, and that did wonders for me. But yeah. I totally get what you're saying, though, in that regard. It's like it does take a mental toll on you when those things start changing, and, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess what I always tell people is that try to embrace every single one of your identities, because I feel like when you don't embrace one of your identities, that's when then you end up not embracing like almost any of your identities, because no matter what, the intersectionality of the different identities will always clash with one another. You know, there is easily always a time when I'm the only Latino in the room, or the only disabled person in the room, or the only gay person in the room. You know, and so no matter what, there is a point in time sometimes where I'm the only, you know, and, you know, fill in the line with
the blank. Yeah.
In the room. And so it's hard. But, you know, as long as you are accepting your identity and you don't let, you know, kind of that bother you, that at times you are the only person in the room. And I think that we can also talk about ableism, of the fact that I think people need to think about disability as a culture, because I think that that's also ableistic, of the fact that, you know, able-bodied people don't take the time to educate themselves about what it is to have a disability, what it means to have a disability. The fact that, you know, most people can only enter a building and not have an issue, but we need help opening doors, we need help finding the ramp or the right exit. And, you know, for someone that, you know, it takes them one step to do something, for us, it might take five steps, right? And it's, yeah, we've adapted to it, and it's part of our lives. And, you know, maybe we're faster at problem solving than your average person, but it takes a toll after a while of having to problem solve, you know, and go through five steps just to be able to enter a building. And then also having someone kind of ask you questions, you know, and then having to educate them on top of you already being exhausted because you had to do five steps to do just the same thing that everyone else did. And so I think that, you know, I think right now what's also happening, I also love that a lot of people are taking the time to read books about social justice and racism. And, you know, with it being SMA Awareness Month, hopefully people will take the time to not only learn about SMA, but just learn about disabilities in general and what the disability movement, you know, looks like, what ableism looks like, and how you can kind of stop ableism with you. And hopefully, you know, I think it also begins at child when you have children and parents tell you not to point or look at someone with a disability. And you end up internalizing that, and then you don't know how to approach us or talk to us or help us.
Yeah. That's great. No, I think that sums up perfectly, and I love that advice you give to people, too, about embracing identities and all that. So, yeah, that's great. Well, Hugo, I know, like I said, you and I could talk, like, all day, but I think we have to wrap it up here. But is there anything else you want to say about either where people can find you or, you know, any resources you want to provide, too?
Yeah, so I right now with everything happening, I have been pretty outspoken. I'll try to post more things too. Right now, sometimes, you know, sometimes it can be hard to post a lot, but if people want to follow me, pretty much my handle is HTREIN2. Sorry, I'm getting a call and it's distracting me.
No worries.
Yeah, handle is HTREVIN2, and you can find me that on I think Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, I believe, or just Hugo Trevino. Feel free to follow me. And yeah.
Absolutely. That's great. Well, Hugo, thanks again for joining us today. This was a great conversation. And, you know, I'm sure we'll do this again. So really appreciate you coming on today. And for our listeners out there, you can find more stories like this by subscribing to this podcast. We are available on Apple Music, SoundCloud, Spotify, and on our main website at smanewstoday.com. So wherever you get your podcast, you know, be sure to follow us. You can also connect with us directly on our forums, and be sure to follow SMA News Today for daily digital coverage of spinal muscular atrophy. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time. Take care.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com, and be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums. a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.